Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm going to talk about our family of origin and how what we learned there is influencing what we think we can do today and even who we think we are. And I'm going to play an interview I did with John Lamb, master bass player who played with Duke Ellington's band and then went on to teach not only in college but in the middle school. So hang on. Here comes the show. To The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about becoming who we really are, not the person that we created or manufactured or tried to fit into who our families wanted us to be or who our boss wants or who our friends thought we should be or any of that, but who underneath it all we really are. The first half of the show, I spend talking about what stops us from being who we really are. I talk about this based on my more than 30 years as a psychotherapist and to some extent from the book I wrote called When You Can, You Will. If you want to know more about any of that, you can find it on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, the E being very important. So, as I said in the first half of the show, I talk about what stops us from being who we really are. In the second half of the show, I'm playing interviews that I did with artists. It's a series I call Anatomy of an Artist. And these interviews focus on how people became who they really are. What it was that made it possible for them to live lives that validated the real them. So this is a pretty full show, and in this show I'm going to talk about the family in the first half and how they set us up to not be who we really are. And in the second half of the show, I'm going to play an interview with bassist John Lamb, late of the Duke Ellington Band, who talks mesmerizingly about music. So now, all about your family. Our family and the earliest years of our childhood are the most significant factors determining who we become and what we can and can't do in our lives. It's the job of our family to instruct us, and intentionally or unintentionally, that is just what it does. Those early lessons, many of which we learned before we had the words with which to articulate them, wield a powerful influence over us for the rest of our lives. It may be a cliche, but it is nonetheless true that what you believe you can and can't do today is based primarily on lessons you learned within your family. Your family was the laboratory where you conducted your most important research. It was there that you learned who you had to be, who you'd better not be, what to expect from the world, and what the world expected from you. I remember being on a bus in Los Angeles once and seeing that there were three mothers sitting in the bus with me and their various children. One of the mothers had a toddler nursing, and it was clearly a cocoon between this mother and this child. There was nobody else in the world. She was completely focused on this child that was nursing. Then there was a mother who had a little girl sitting on her lap. And although they were sitting there together, they were not interacting. They were both sort of looking around and paying attention to their surroundings. And then there was an overworked mother with three toddlers, one on her lap and two crawling around under the seats and making a lot of noise, and she wasn't paying any attention to them. And I remember thinking at the time that these children are learning right this second what the world will be like for them. The little one whose mother was completely enmeshed with her, or him, as it nursed, will grow up to think that they are an important something. They are someone that the world should pay attention to and maybe even revolve around. The little kids who were so busy trying to get mom's attention and not getting it are learning that they are not going to get attention. This is how we learned, as I said, what to expect from the world and what the world might expect from us. Now, ignoring the legacy of your childhood will not make it go away. You may never act on what the information that you learn here. But the more you know about the lessons that you were taught by your family, the better you'll understand your reluctance to make meaningful changes today. You may believe that you've left behind whatever influence your family ever had over you. You may not like or even speak to family members today, but events you've forgotten, ideas you thought you'd outgrown, attitudes you believe you've discredited, and alliances you deny still reach out from the past to affect your idea of who you are. And it is this idea of yourself which determines how smoothly you can operate in the world. Your idea of yourself is based not at all on who you actually are, but on how you interpreted the needs of your family. Things like your place in the birth order, your sex, who you were named for or who you look like, who the family needed a child to be when you were born, or who your parents were and how you modeled yourself after them. It is these things that form the basis of your idea of yourself. By carefully observing what worked and what didn't work in your particular family, you decided which parts of your personality to express and which to hide. Your decision to present certain qualities and hide others was based on how well each quality was received by your family. You know, what this means is that you were a whole range of things, and many of those things may have gotten hidden. That doesn't mean you don't still have them. It means that you found a way not to have access to them. Because by responding positively or negatively, family members let you know how often. By responding positively or negatively, family members let you know often, instantly, which of your behaviors were acceptable and which were taboo. Self-protectively, over time, you displayed the one and disowned the other. The more your parents accepted you as you really were, the less you had to hide or invent. The less you were their idea of the perfect child, the more you had to create or deny. If the change you want to make today requires you to be someone you weren't allowed to be as a child, you may feel strong internal resistance to that change. If the change you want to make today requires you to express a quality that was unacceptable to your family when you were a child, you may, as an adult, feel a terrible taboo against expressing that quality. For example, if your mother believed that men were brash and bold and women should be shy, well, she communicated this belief to you. And as her son, you may have found it easy to speak your mind, but as her daughter, you didn't. Let's say you are this daughter, and the change you want to make today is to stand up for yourself in your marriage. In your mind's eye, you can still see your mother's scowling face and feel her disapproval of an outspoken daughter. This alone can make it difficult for you to do what you want to do. You may not actually remember your mother's scowling face. You may think that you're no longer affected by what your mother thought or what she taught you. But the roles adopted in childhood are such powerful reflexes that even if you don't see the subliminal flash of your mother's disapproving face, it still affects you. Remember, if you were listening the last few weeks, I was talking about brain chemistry and how our brain learns what stimulus requires what response. So, if you're this daughter, and you're thinking of standing up to your husband, thinking of standing up to someone that is important to you, someone on whom your life may depend in some important ways, that stimulus will trigger the, uh-oh, don't talk, don't be outspoken, don't make waves, chemical in your bloodstream. So you may not see your mother's scowling face. You may not even remember those early times when you stamped your foot in a childish rage and the disapproval or maybe even punishment that came from mommy. But your brain remembers, and it drops the appropriate chemical in your bloodstream, and it makes it difficult/impossible for you to act in the way that not only you want to, but that would be appropriate today. It is not knowing that what's going on here is that an old learning is being re-triggered, that an old neuron is firing, and it is a chemical in your bloodstream that is stopping you from doing this thing. Until you know that, you just feel, oh, I just can't do that. I don't know why. I get tongue-tied. I get scared. I get sick to my stomach. I forget what I was going to say. But it isn't any of that. It's a chemical in your bloodstream telling you that this is dangerous. And that was put there in those early days, learned very, very young. Now, the idea that events from the past can influence your ability to make decisions in the present, that may annoy you. You may even want to discount the possibility. But as the philosopher George Santayana told us, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. When an old learning has been re-triggered, when a neuron is firing and a chemical is being dropped in our bloodstream that is the result of something we learned many, many years ago in our childhood, I think of it as our being in the presence of the past, not in the presence of the present. That is, that we are not doing what our present conditions require. We are not being who we are in the present. We are reacting to something we learned very, very long ago, and in a very powerful way, we're actually still in the past. So if you were that daughter at that moment when you want to tell your husband that you don't like the way he's talking to you, or you'd like to go to a different restaurant, or, well, whatever it is, you're not the grown-up woman that you are expressing what you're thinking in the present. You're a little girl reacting to a disapproving mother. You are literally in the presence of the past. So perhaps you can see how important it is to learn as much as you can about the legacy of your childhood. Because the better you grasp the lessons that your family taught you, the more clearly you understand who your family taught you to be, what they taught you to expect from life, the better chance you'll have to interrupt those neural firings, literally to change your brain chemistry. If you were not listening in the last few weeks when I've been talking about brain chemistry and how these things occur, and then last week when I was talking about how you can interrupt brain chemistry, how we can actually change it, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com. They're not up there yet, the podcasts, but I am hoping that I'm trying to learn how to get stuff up on my website, so that when the web guys don't do it quickly enough, I can. But this is a learning curve that's really difficult for me to accomplish. Anyway, I'm working on it. And at some point, all those shows will be up there. The early shows, at least probably by now, all the shows of last year are up there. But the shows from this year may not yet be there. Anyway, the brain chemistry stuff will be up there, and you can listen to it there. Or you can go on the website and click on Contact Me and ask me questions, and I will be happy to respond. And now, after a short break, I'm going to play the interview that I did with John Lamb. And following the interview, I'm going to play a piece of music from a CD that he gave me that highlights a bass solo of his, which is just delightful. So, right after this break, John Lamb.
I can work the whole damn day, way into the night. Look like I don't need to play. I make out all right, and although I can fool you with my grown-up woman style, behind the woman there's a child.
So I'm here with John Lamb again.
Again.
John and I did this once before. We talked for over an hour.
Yes.
He told me everything there is to know about John Lamb, and I hadn't recorded it.
I'm not certain that I would remember everything that we talked about.
No, I remember a lot of it, but it's okay. I'm not going to ask you to do that again because it seems unfair. But you had just started to say, this is how you play your solos.
Mm.
You remember?
Yes. A bass solo is a composition within a composition.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I form. I have a beginning. I make like A form, you know, A, B. Now, section A, I'll say something. And section B, I'll do something different.
You're making a composition.
Yes. And that's what's good. They call it building a solo.
Who calls it?
Oh, a lot of people in the music world. They call it building a solo. And so we build on sections like art,
mm-hmm.
like poetry.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Well, and I'm gonna ask you, I didn't ask you, but I want a copy of you playing something. I want some of your music so I can play that for these people, especially if you have an example of what you're talking about, you know, a solo that you
have on CD somewhere that I can...
Well, I'll get the one with the Far East Suite of Duke Ellington.
Oh, lovely.
Okay, it's called Ad Lib on Nippon.
Ad Lib on Nippon?
Yes.
As in Japan?
Yeah.
Really?
And that'll give you some of... You'll find the composition within the composition.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking it's really too bad. Most of the people who are going to listen to this interview, who are listening to this interview, will not have had an opportunity to hear you play. They won't have an opportunity to hear you do these solos live, spontaneously, as I have. And they're just amazing. You can feel it in the room when you start to play. No matter what's been going on before, that everybody is riveted. And it must be because not only you're so skilled, but because you're doing this thing, you're building something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's something that everyone can relate to.
Yes, yes.
It's simple.
Well...
Oh, well, I've gone through every method book in this conservatory, but I can never use all of that. I only need the most important notes. notes that people can hear,
yes,
and feel. And we use our melody and rhythm and harmony and our compositional forms. Excuse me. And you put all those skills together and simplify it, and it comes out as a well-rounded composition.
Yeah, well, I probably you know this, but you're also funny when you play.
I am.
You are.
How?
I'm not sure. The noise you hear in the background is my dog chewing her bone. I'm trying to think. I don't know. I thought it was what you choose to play. Sometimes you'll reference other songs, and that'll be interesting. But it's whimsical. You're whimsical when you play. Did you not think so?
I don't know. The music is coming through me the way,
yes,
I feel about it.
Right, right. Have you not noticed that people smile and giggle,
yes,
and laugh when you play?
Yes.
They do.
Yeah. You know, I'm not trying to revolutionize the bass. It will happen. Or I'm not trying to revolutionize music. I only play music that's based on my own experiences. I'm not trying to emulate or imitate something that I heard on a record.
No, that's really clear, because nothing I have heard you play have I ever heard anywhere before.
Yeah, and in the beginning, I had to imitate in order to learn. But as the years have gone by, I play whatever
comes out
up here.
Right, right.
That's right.
Now, that's an interesting thing. Does it go through your head, or is it just in your fingers? You know what I mean?
Well, some of it is emotional, some of it is thought of, it's a combination,
mm-hmm,
and some of it, of course, is having motorized the fingers.
The fingers, yeah.
But it's a combination of all those things, and it's a combination of the environment that I've been exposed to.
Yeah.
It's all those things, and
so,
the different musicians and so on.
So when you start to do a solo, do you have some idea of what you're going to do?
Well, I think I have about 12 or 13 notes to choose from, right? I know all the notes.
I know. Yes, you do.
Yeah. And you know, it's just a matter of putting these combinations together so that they will make sense. You see, I understand that the ear is built a certain way, harmonically speaking.
I don't understand.
When we go to a doctor's office,
right,
they play, when we have a hearing test, they play certain tones,
right,
for us, and we raise our hands. These tones are harmonics,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you take any string, guitar string, bass string, it's based upon harmonics.
Right.
All of music is based upon harmonics. And you can find every note in the scale in each one of those strings, you know, in just open positions. They're all there. Now, all I'm saying is this, I choose whatever note that I feel, you know, based on my studies that I would like to do and things that I hear coming out of someone else.
What else is playing, right.
That's what I meant earlier about not being together with that
Yeah, no, I understand.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because sometimes other things get in the way of what I'm feeling or hearing.
Right.
And so, and in accompanying, I'm skipping around a little bit.
This is fine.
In accompanying, people that are accompanying have to be very sensitive.
Yes.
As to what the person that's out front trying to do, because a bass player does that all of the time. I have to be sensitive enough to accompany and not get in the way of what the performer is doing.
Yes.
And when it's the reverse, a lot of them have not had the experience.
They just don't understand that.
And they fall all over you. They step all over you.
That's right.
So, you know.
Well, and I know because I've sung in front of you that you're supporting what I'm doing. And it's like a dance, you know.
That's what it is. And, you know, it's a matter of respect for someone else's skill and their abilities and whatever they're trying to say. If they want to say it on this level or high level or low level, it doesn't matter to me. I'm still going to play the same notes.
Yeah.
Same 12, 12, aren't they? 12 notes, I haven't counted them lately, but they're 12 or 13. But I'm
I don't think they've changed, actually.
No, I'm going to play the same notes. Of course, if they play a little bit out of tune, then I have to go a little bit higher or a little bit lower in order to blend with whatever they're doing.
Are you really?
Yeah. I've been in situations in the band where the trumpet section would play with a certain structure or harmonic feeling or a sound or whatever it is, and I have to play with them one way. And then when the saxophones came in, I had to play a different way with them. And when they finished, when the trio section played, I had to play a different way.
Oh my God.
Sound. Sure.
Now, did you learn that, or is this intuitive?
Well, over the years, I learned it.
No, I mean, were you taught it? Or did you just figure it out?
No, I wasn't taught that.
No, I never heard this before.
Well, because I learned over the years.
So you learned it from playing?
From playing, yeah.
And from having an extraordinary ear and a lot of sensitivity. Do you have a favorite kind of music that you like to play?
I love music. I can sit and listen to anybody, but not everybody too long. It doesn't matter if it's jazz, I can't take too much of it at one time. If it's classical, I can't take too much of it at one time. Country music, I can't take too much of it one time. Or any kind. But I can listen to anybody's music for a short period of time. We're dealing with notes and we're dealing with vibrations of air. Mm. And everybody expresses themselves in their own manner. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make one more right than the other. It's still the same things, you know, the same vibration. And so I have an appreciation because having taught kids, they come in from different cultures and they bring their own ideas. I used to have the kids bring in their music once a week to show us what they like.
Do you want to explain what you taught, the circumstances under which you were teaching?
Explain what I taught?
Yeah, just tell. So, I mean, these people don't know.
Oh, I taught music in a middle school, music appreciation. I taught chorus and band. And then I taught at the college.
So in the middle school, you had them bringing in the music that they like?
Yeah.
So what did they bring in?
Whatever they had in their drawer at home, whatever they liked. And I had all kinds of things come in. You see, we're there to teach everyone, not just a few people. The few snobbish few, as I say.
Yes, yes.
Everybody should be able to enjoy.
Okay, all right. So what I hear is a shocking lack of judgment. So how did you arrive at that?
A shocking
lack of judgment. I mean, it's a funny way to say it, but I mean...
You mean judging someone else's culture or background?
Yeah, a shocking amount of acceptance.
Well, I'm a teacher of humanity. not just a few people, you know.
But so how did that happen?
I learned it.
Where did you learn
it? I learned it from having taken all those methods courses... college courses.
No, those
and people's courses.
Those courses quite
and play
often.
And clubs and all that stuff. All of that.
I don't know, John.
Wait
I think
a minute.
That's a personal thing. I think that's a part of the person.
Well, where? I had to learn it somewhere.
Well, what about your family?
What about them?
Were they accepting or were they judgmental?
I have several families now.
No, I'm talking about the first family. Did you think of them as kind of inclusive, or did you think of them as exclusive and judgmental?
My family was never judgmental. They were very supportive. They didn't know exactly what I was doing all the time, but they were very supportive, and I was encouraged.
Yeah, that's where it comes from.
Yeah.
See, that's where it comes from.
But I think I've been very fortunate in the respect that I've been able to appreciate everyone's music. And yeah. I think that's the role of a teacher.
Well, yes, clearly that is a necessity for any kind of good teaching, is the ability to incorporate everybody and accept everybody and let everybody be their best.
I heard some things in your music the other day that were delightful. Yes. Sometime I'll go through it with you and say,
will you really?
Can I hear this? Sure, I'll play it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Wow. So, still, you know, a lot of musicians are snobs.
Yeah.
Especially musicians with your level of skill and...
Especially those that think that they have the inside track.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's why certain types of music have gone down in popularity, because a lot of them have forgotten about the people. And some people, when they figure they have learned so much or they have gained so much knowledge, everyone else is sort of like...
beneath them.
Yeah. And then it's the other way around, too. A lot of people that come in the places and the clubs, they're not good listeners either.
No.
So it works both ways.
Yes.
You see, we need at least three elements when performing music. We need to have a performer.
Mm-hmm.
We need a composer. Mm. A composer can be somebody walking down the streets whistling something that they don't know anything about.
Yes.
Got to have a composer. You got to have somebody to capture that melody. You need someone else to perform it. And you need listeners.
Yes. Yes.
Got to have listeners. So all of these have to come together in order for it to be really, really successful. I once heard a great man say this. Why is it, it's a jazz musician too, why is it that the Europeans seem to appreciate your music more than the Americans? The reply was, they have older ears.
Yeah. You know, there's a story about, this American landscape artist who wanted to learn to create the perfect lawn. And so he went to England because they've got these incredible lawns, right? And I think it's true. And so he went to learn, to study with the English, landscape people. So he said to this English landscape guy, how did you make this amazing lawn? And the guy said, well, you know, you put the seed down, and then you water it, and you do it for 100 years. There is something to be said,
yes,
for the depth of experience.
Definitely.
Okay, so nobody in your family played. Is that correct?
You're talking about
musicians, your family, your first family.
First family.
Right, the family into whom you were born.
My mother didn't play an instrument. My daddy didn't play an instrument. My sister did not play an instrument. One sister played a little piano, yes. I had a brother that played nothing but sports.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
So where did you come from, John, then?
I don't know where I came from. You know, my mother asked that one time.
Did she?
Yeah, where did you come from? I said, look, I came from you.
And she said...
No, she used to sing a lot in church, and they all sang, and they all... went to church.
So they loved music.
And of course. Everybody loved music. Music was our saving grace. That's the only thing we had going for us.
Yes.
since the early 1500s or 1600s, you know. And so it's just a part of the culture. And you went to church and you sang and you got rid of all those weekly
right.
frustrations
right.
and all that kind of stuff.
And you, right.
Sure.
Because anybody who sings knows that when you're singing, everything is fine.
When a person says, use the syllable om.
Om, yes.
That's singing. And so singing, as you know, does a lot of things that the so-called om does. Except there's only one pitch. All
right.
pitches are encompassed into one. And it's supposed to go through the roof of the head and all that stuff
yes.
and fill all the cavities.
There's nothing wrong when you're singing.
You know, I had a couple of semesters of voice.
Oh, yeah.
One was from a student in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. She had to grab somebody and teach them as part of her teaching experience.
So she
grabbed
you.
Me. So I sang for her, and then later on, for recertification in the school system, I took voice for a couple of semesters.
Mm-hmm.
And the singing, what it does, it just causes vibrations throughout the entire head, mm-hmm. and the tears just come down. And she was talking about all of this, and she says, that's okay. So it's a wonderful experience. The singing experience is wonderful.
I know. And what's sad is that so many people aren't able to sing because they get judged. That's not a good voice, or you're not on pitch, or you're not, whatever it is, you know. So is it similar when you're playing? Because it sure looks like you're completely connected to the thing.
Oh, definitely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, like, the world is barely there.
There is a connection. There is an esoteric thing that says that the human form is used as a vehicle to express what it has to say.
And does that mean that...
Let me say that again.
Please.
There's an esoteric saying, not commonly used, that we, our physical beings, are used as vehicles to say or express something that is greater than ourselves.
Yes.
One of them being vibrations of air, and we call it
sound.
Or sound. Organized sound. Some of it's noise because it has been distorted.
Okay.
Because your vibrations are irregular, and those vibrations that are regular comes out as a song or sound.
Is this
Did
like...
Did that come out right?
What?
Did that come out right?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yeah.
Is it a kind of a universal thing that we're expressing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you said it right there. You've heard the expression that music is universal.
Yes, that's
what
right.
It is.
Right. And so it's a kind of a joining thing. It joins people,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it
We played all over the world, and people have come together as a result of that. They loved it. They didn't know what we were playing, but...
Yes, but they felt it.
Yeah.
It enters the person at a place below the conscious mind.
Everything in the universe vibrates. When we talk,
we're vibrating.
When we move,
right.
Everything vibrates at a different rate of speed. And that's what gives each little entity its own characteristic, because of the speed and the rate at which they are vibrating.
So that is something that joins us. That we're all
like. That's what we are.
Right. You wouldn't know that to see how.
Well, maybe a lot of humanity hasn't evolved to that level yet.
Clearly.
They're using distorted vibrations of air.
And making noise.
Trying to communicate with each other.
Right.
What do you think bombs are? That's distortion. Vibrations distorted. They make noise.
Well, they do.
But if those sounds were more organized, I think people would come together. And it's based on love.
Yes.
I'm not talking about physical love. It's a love that transcends
division.
That's right.
Yes. So in an ironic way, as a musician, you are joining people. That's what you're doing.
People come there to feel good.
Yes, they do.
They don't give a damn what you had for breakfast.
Right.
They want to know what you're going to do to make them feel good.
Right. Actually, they don't give a damn about anything about you.
That's right.
Except that this thing that you're doing, right, exactly, it's coming through. And
I see the smiles on their faces.
Yes.
I see the smile, and that's called returning. We're giving to them, and they're giving back. It takes a great deal of understanding, though. A great deal of understanding to know that people are on different levels. They're also on different levels of musicianship. That's why we're sort of tolerant of others.
Right.
Not on our levels, and others are tolerant toward me if I don't do what they want, or either that or get somebody else, you know.
Right.
But it's that's what it is. You have so many different levels of things here, and they are endless.
Yes. But underneath, it's all the same.
Yeah.
Right.
One big
vibration.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're right.
I don't know who created the vibration. They say the earth came about as a result of a big bang. Mm-hmm. Something was vibrating out there in the universe to cause it to crash or explode.
Right.
Their vibrations. There are only three things in existence: light, color, and sound. I made a bold statement.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
But think about it. Look at the light.
Right.
Look at the color. Then you look out of there. Sound, vibrations are there. Look at it. Light.
It is, isn't
vibration.
It? Yes, it does.
Color has certain vibrations.
Right.
That's why it looks a certain way. Red, blue, white, green, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Sound, light, colors. Huh?
So, did you always have this idea?
No. It was acquired over a period of time.
So, you found music before you found this?
I found my music after I found myself.
Could you say something about that?
The more I learned how to live, the more the music came through. Mm-hmm. People could understand. There was a time when I was on stage and I was playing all kinds of fancy notes. Fast, you know, young teenager, you know. And it didn't mean a thing to the listeners.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear you say that. And when you say it, I know one of the things that's so wonderful about listening to you is that you don't do that. You're not showing off. You're not saying, see how many notes I can play in this short period of time. You are playing something that matters, that we can grab onto, that speaks. You know, it's not just... See, I can play all these notes in this chord. I know where all the notes in this chord are, you know. And so many people think that that's really virtuosity. But I never have.
You know, a lot of, like, as you said, some people think a lot of notes is virtuosity. But the sound itself is, which is one of the elements of speed. Well, sound, the way it comes across. Oh, the way one looks at another person when they're playing certain notes. That was meant for you. And this is meant for you. You see, if you were into the technical bag, you see, I'll do something there for you. to show that, well, it's possible, but that's not the whole bag. There are many, many elements. It's like looking at the sunset. There are many colors.
Yes.
You choose whatever you would like and add that to your...
Take what you like and leave the rest.
Right. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And it explains a lot about why you play the way you do. And it's so interesting. I mean, do you remember when you started to develop especially the solo style? Do you remember when you started to develop this, how this happened?
I was told that this may sound egotistical.
We'll risk it.
But I remember a good friend of mine in Philadelphia told me, he says, I used to watch you play, and believe it or not, you played with an attitude that of kindness, mm-hmm. not one of ego, one of being above someone else. He says, you came into town and you proved to musicians that you can play and still be kind and good. And
that it's not a competition.
Yeah. And he says, I believe that you raised the level. And, you know, I didn't know this until about 4 years ago. And I was in Philly in the early 60s. He just came out and said this, you know. He says, yes, you did that. Those kind of statements are humbling statements, you know. I mean, things that makes me feel, you know.
Well, are you saying that other people could see this in you and you didn't really get it?
No, I didn't get it. And they said also that, he says, whenever you played a solo, he says, there were trumpet players and piano players that were envious. I had no idea.
No, because you weren't.
But others were observing.
Right.
And, you know, he didn't have to say this to me.
No, of course not.
And he said it to me several times since then.
But you're aware of it now.
Well, I'm beginning to accept it. But, you know, it's
well, so I'm so glad you lived long enough to do that.
Yeah. And like I said, it's really humbling when somebody says that to you.
Well, but, you know, it seems to me that it's the same thing. It's that basic lack of competition, of judgment, of who's being better, or who's doing better. You just don't have that. You know, for you, people are equal, and the work is the work. Do you know what I mean? And that's what comes through. That's what comes through.
Well, a lot of people have to compete for jobs.
Yes, that's true, but when you're playing, competition does not contribute to good music. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, okay, fine, you have to get the gig, but once you've got the gig, it's knowing that you're in it together, right? And that you don't... And this is just not true in our culture. This is not a culture of team. This is a culture of I have to stand out, otherwise I don't. Otherwise I feel bad, or I haven't achieved, or whatever. So it's real remarkable that you have developed this way of being.
That's very fortunate.
I agree. I agree. But I think this has got to go back to your family.
And others. There are many people.
Oh, so you can see, I can see it in your eyes that you know who they are.
Many people, yeah. Not just family.
So you had a lot of...
I had many families. I mean, people that I love, I respect their opinions. I always listened. A person could say something to me. I didn't necessarily agree with it. So what I would do is grab it and put it on a shelf someplace.
Yeah.
And maybe somewhere down the line it might come back. I'll reach up on the shelf.
Oh, yeah.
Use a little of this.
Right, right.
That's what it was.
But again, it's the same thing. It's that you didn't dismiss out of hand pretty much anything.
I always figure that people can learn things from anyone, even the so-called person that is the wino, or they call him a wino, but at least I can learn how to drink wine. You know, that's something. I might not want to drink it.
Right.
You know, but that's what I just put it up there.
But that's what he has to offer.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you value it.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. It's the same thing as you were talking about with the kids in the class. Yeah. Is that might not be your music, but you valued the fact that they valued it.
Yeah.
That's so, I think that's really unusual.
I don't know.
Never mind, you don't have to know.
Right.
You just have to be.
Yeah.
I do, I think it's unusual. And I think it's wonderful that you taught. They should insist that people like you teach. Well, okay. Let me just ask you, is there anything that you would want to say about being a musician, about being an artist, about making a life with music, or anything else for that matter?
Well, I think musicians should be more diversified if they're going to make it as in the commercial part of it.
Mm. You mean they should have something to fall back on? Is that what you mean? Or they should play more than one kind of music?
They should take lessons, not necessarily from the financial world today, but things that the financial world has taught us over the years.
To be careful about money. Is that what you mean?
If they're going to survive.
If they're going to survive, yeah.
Since we're in that kind of society.
Yes, we don't take care of our itinerant musicians in this society, so they have to be
and
able
to... musicians need to learn to take care of themselves.
So many of the musicians that I have talked to have said the same thing. Well, a variation on this theme. You know, don't expect this to take care of you.
That's right.
Take care of yourself, right? Well, all right, so we're going to stop. And who knows, since this is the second time, maybe there'll be more. Thank you so much, John Lamb.
Oh, you're quite welcome, Leah.
And that is the Nate Nahar Trio from a CD called Live at the Side Door. It's Nate on guitar, Chuck Redd on drums, and the incomparable John Lamb on bass. And on that sweet note, we come to the end of this show. And I get to thank Josh Hackney, as I always do, my IT guru guy, who makes sure that the show sounds as good as it possibly can sound, and is there at my back when I can't do something, or I have forgotten how to do something that I do know how to do. Josh either shows up, or he calls me and walks me through it. There's a mindset for this, which I don't seem to be able to develop, but fortunately for me, there is Josh Hackney. And if you have questions, needs, requirements that have to do with recording or electronics or computer, you want Josh at your back as well. So again, you can go up on my website, thelinshow.com, click on Contact Me, say I need Josh, and I will get him for you. But now I am hoping that this show provided you with something that you can use, something that entertained you or stimulated you, something that makes you want to come back next week. Because next week, at 1 o'clock on Tuesday, Eastern Standard Time, and 3 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Monday, I will be here, and I hope you will be too. Tune in again next week when I will play the first half of an interview with actress, director, commercial star Pam Wiley, and I'll begin to talk about family balance and how that has an impact on what you think you can and cannot do when you grow up.
No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got to